The new iPhone? We're not going to talk about it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, September 9th. Thanks so much for joining us. It's that time of year again when Apple unveils its newest gadgets, to the delight and sometimes disappointment of Apple fans. Molly Wood is Marketplace's senior tech correspondent. She was in the audience today and joins us from outside the Bill Graham Civic Auditorium. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Adrienne.
So set the scene for us, if you will. What was it like there at the event today?
You know, this is the first time that Apple's had an event at this venue, and a venue change for them is actually sort of a big deal. It's a big theater, so it was a lot more crowded, and it gave kind of a festive air overall, especially with all these sort of cameras set up. I don't know that it necessarily raised the excitement level during the announcement, but certainly as people were filing in, they were pretty buzzy.
So lots of news from Apple today, but what of what they said actually matters? What should we care about?
Yeah, I mean, of course, people are going to care that there's a new iPhone, and a lot of professionals are going to care about this new iPad Pro. But the device that actually really stole the show was the Apple TV. It was an impressive tech demo. It was sort of a new philosophy from Tim Cook and Apple on how to approach integrating internet content and the television, but it was also notable for what was missing.
Explain.
So there have been rumors for a long time that Apple would announce some sort of a subscription TV streaming service, something to rival Sling TV and be sort of an over-the-top option for cord cutters. And by most reports, they failed to secure the deals. They didn't get the licensing deals to announce that service today. It's delayed or maybe never coming. And so there was a sense, I think, that they were trying to make the best of a bad situation by really focusing instead on apps on Apple TV instead of TV on Apple TV.
And Molly, what's that mean? What are we supposed to be doing with our television with these apps?
Well, apparently we're supposed to be playing games,
okay,
which was not unexpected, but we're also supposed to be shopping. The head of Gilt, the discount shopping, luxury shopping goods app, came on stage and demonstrated how you could shop for clothes and sort of do frictionless buying, which is tempting, but there was a little bit of a sense of confusion in the air. I think people were wondering what you would really do with a whole new app store, like the one on your phone, once it was on a TV.
So why does Apple need TV at all? Why go into this space if it doesn't have these content deals?
Well, the living room has really, for maybe the past year or two, become kind of the next battleground for your attention and your eyeballs and maybe your shopping. You know, you have Amazon building its Fire TV, which is an Apple TV competitor. Google has the Chromecast. They're all trying to get control of what you consume so that they can either sell it to you or rent it to you. And if Apple can make an app store successful on the TV, they stand to make a lot of money. The app store is very profitable for them on phones and tablets. So it's not totally illogical to go in that direction, but I think most people had a hard time imagining how it might work.
And more broadly, based on sort of today, what sense do you have of the direction Apple is going as a company?
Yeah, you know, I think that this was a very practical event in some ways, as much as they tried to hype it as revolutionary and innovative. In fact, it wasn't that innovative. The iPhone is the next iteration. The iPad Pro is a very powerful looking device, but it emulates devices that are already on the market. The Apple TV does some great navigation. It uses Siri and it has a touchpad integrated in the remote. But again, you didn't see anything brand new. What you did see is refinement and features that will probably appeal to people who have been waiting for a better option.
And the market is not that happy with today's shindig. Apple stock prices are down. What do you make of that?
You know, that's not unusual after an Apple event, especially lately in the past few years, I think. Look, innovation is hard. It's going to be hard to invent the next iPhone. And so I think everyone is a little disappointed when Apple doesn't come out with a hovercraft. But iteration does not excite.
Fair enough. Marketplace's Molly Wood, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
On Wall Street today, it wasn't just Apple. Investors just weren't feeling it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The The head of the EU Commission says all of Europe needs to share responsibility for the hundreds of thousands of refugees who've arrived on the continent. More than 160,000 migrants have crossed into Hungary alone this year. An additional 40,000 migrants are expected by the end of the week. The BBC's Nick Thorpe spent the day at a holding camp in Ruska, Hungary.
It's 7 in the morning. The sun has been up for nearly an hour. I'm standing in a big field of small tents where about 1,000 refugees slept last night. Some are still sleeping on cardboard or mats. Others are crouched around small fires, burning rubbish to keep warm. In a larger tent, Jakob and his friends, volunteers from Germany, are serving breakfast.
We came here as volunteers to help or support the refugees at the situation at the border. And now we're at the food stand here, and we're giving out food.
A man's just taken a whole loaf of bread. The children are interested in the chocolates especially, and there's also grapes.
There was a lot more food yesterday night when we arrived, but now overnight I think there were even more refugees this night than before, so it's all gone. We're running pretty low on everything.
As the morning wore on and more people arrived, walking down the railway line from Serbia, the field got increasingly crowded and tense. When a bus did arrive to take migrants to a nearby pre-registration centre, all hell broke loose.
My daughter is here! She's 5 years!
Hundreds of people tried to get aboard. Family members were separated. Ahmed from Syria blamed his own people, not the police.
They don't know anything called the queue, you know. Everybody wants to be first. Everybody is making troubles. So police are really getting angry because of this. They cannot even get in one queue.
But for many in the field, where some had been waiting for days, the chaos around the bus was the last straw. Around 300 broke through a thin line of police and began running away through the cornfields. It was mayhem. Most escaped. Police knocked stragglers to the ground. We're like rabbits escaping hunters, one man told me.
It's really difficult, you know. It's 19 days on the bad weather, on the route, on the floor, sleeping. Some of them sick.
Jalal is from Iraq and is traveling with his wife and four children.
Some of them, they cannot find good food. Some of them, they cannot find good medicine. Nobody care about them. The government of Hungary, they don't have children. They don't care. I don't know why. I don't know what's the reason.
As dusk fell, the field returned to something like normal, a sea of litter. More buses came at last. Tents were abandoned to new occupants. A calm spell fell on the field. The Hungarian government continues to portray this as a law and order problem with a police and army solution. Aid workers say it's a humanitarian crisis and that the people need information and protection.
That was the BBC's Nick Thorpe reporting from Hungary. And Europe more broadly is grappling with how to deal with the crisis against a backdrop of economic malaise. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more on what the crisis could cost the region in the short term.
There's 6 million euros for a migrant camp in France. The UK spends £700,000 a day housing asylum seekers while they're being processed. The EU, by some estimates, is prepared to spend €1 billion on relocating migrants. And Germany is setting aside $6.6 billion. That sounds like a lot. It is a lot. But Dimitri Papadimitriou, president of the Migration Policy Institute's European office, says it doesn't stop there.
It will be in the billions and no probability into the tens of billions.
But that's small compared to Europe's total GDP, $18 trillion. Simon de Galbert is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
It's very difficult to envision a significant impact on the European GDP.
He says countries like Germany or Austria in particular can afford to absorb refugees, but not every country in Europe is so lucky. Abdur Chaudhry is professor of economics at Marquette University.
If we look at the countries in the periphery, like Hungary, for example, those countries will face serious problem if they have to allocate some scarce resources for the migrants.
The European Union is offering some support to those countries, but the biggest economic blows are landing outside of Europe. Lebanon, with a population of 4.5 million, hosts 1 million refugees, and its GDP growth is expected to fall 3% a year. Turkey hosts half of all Syrian migrants. Again, Dimitri Papadimitriou.
We're doing a terrible job as far as our response to the challenges that these countries are facing.
Preventing those countries from destabilizing is a whole other set of costs. Misery is expensive everywhere. Of course, those paying the highest price for it are the migrants themselves. I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The number of fatal traffic accidents here in the U.S. is rising. According to the National Safety Council, they're up 14% this year. And it turns out there could be an economic explanation. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
The numbers don't look good. Darren Grant focuses on the economic indicators of traffic fatalities at Sam Houston State University. He says this new data makes sense. People don't drive to work when they're unemployed.
During that 2007 to 2010, if you look over that window, the reduction in fatalities was so great, it actually amounted to about 1% of GDP.
Grant says there's enough evidence to tie traffic fatalities to two factors, declining unemployment and lower gas prices. Both are happening right now. The Department of Transportation won't attribute cause to the surge in traffic fatalities, like more people on the road or texting while driving. But Ken Kolosh will. He's manager of statistics with the National Safety Council.
Once the economy starts improving, we start seeing the miles start to increase, as then we see fatalities start to increase also.
So what does that mean for your car insurance premium? James Lynch is chief actuary with the Insurance Information Institute. He says there are essentially three things that make up that rate: the number of cars, the number of accidents, and how bad those accidents are.
And the amount of premium that a company collects in the course of a year is a function of those three things.
Allstate has already gotten approval to raise rates by almost 4% in many states. And GEICO says it's likely to raise rates as well. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up,
you don't see functioning homes. I mean, you see literally across the street was, bombed out old apartment complex.
Students graduating in post-bankruptcy Detroit. But first, let's do the numbers. Yep, we had a down day after a rosy start on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 239 points, 1.4%, to close at 16,253. The Nasdaq gave back 55 points, 1.1%, to finish at 4756. The S&P 500 was off 27 points, 1.4%, to end the day at 1942. The Barnes & Noble bookstore chain was a big loser today. Shares dropped 27% after it reported a decline in sales for the fifth straight quarter. Lower online sales and a weak demand for its Nook tablet took some of the blame. Netflix gained more than 4% on the day after announcing it would expand to four Asian countries, including South Korea. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.18%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. Today, McDonald's announced a 10-year plan to get all the eggs it uses from farms with cage-free hens. That means the hens will have enough room to walk, perch, and spread their wings. Other big food companies, including rival Burger King, have made similar moves to cage-free eggs. It could have a big effect on the egg industry. But just how carefree are cage-free chickens? Marketplace's Annie Baxter reports.
We're mostly oblivious to where our eggs come from. Maybe we picture hens on a pastoral farm with rolling hills. Not so, says Paul Shapiro with the Humane Society of the United States.
You have some of these facilities that have tens of millions of animals on one property. Tens of millions. They're locked so overcrowded, crammed wing to wing and beak to beak, and stacked in cages from the floor to the ceiling. This is where the term factory farm comes from.
Shapiro says, by contrast, cage-free hens can move around in a barn from one level to the next. Shapiro says it's important that McDonald's and other big food companies are going cage-free, but he says even cage-free birds may never go outside, and they're still in a facility with tens of thousands of birds.
It doesn't necessarily mean they're living in bucolic conditions, but it does mean that the birds have a better quality of life.
If we're going to feed a growing population, you have to have infrastructure to be able to do that.
Marion Gross is chief supply chain officer of McDonald's North America. She says at some point the company could have some egg production come from free-range hens, the ones with a more bucolic existence. But that would be difficult when you use 2 billion eggs a year. Meanwhile, she says McDonald's could forge improvements in cage-free systems.
We believe that, you know, we're going to help move that along even further because our volumes and our scale is so big, we're helping to change the industry.
But those changes will come at a cost to farmers. Many of them plan for 20 years of egg production out of the thousands of cages they use. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
In fashion, it seems old is always new again. Check out the flare pants that are back on the runways. In Uganda, designers are trying to revive interest in a cloth people there have been wearing for the past 600 years. It's made from the bark of a tree, and at least according to UNESCO, it predates the invention of weaving. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams was recently in Uganda and has our story.
The rural village of Masaka is a bumpy, as in you'd better be wearing your seatbelt bumpy, two-hour drive from Uganda's capital. It's where Bukenya Katimira and his family have been producing bark cloth for generations. He invited me to his farm for a demonstration. First, he carefully scrapes the outer layer of thin white bark from the matuba tree, a kind of ficus, then peels off the inner layer. After boiling the bark to release the sap, Katimir stretches it out by pounding it with grooved wooden mallets. He proudly shows me one mallet that belonged to his grandfather, pounding away as the bark slowly doubles, then triples in size.
This has been my family business for 300 years, and I'm passing it on to my son and grandchildren.
The same trees, with proper care, can be harvested for generations. These days, Ugandans wear bark cloth for formal events like funerals and tribal festivities, but not for ordinary dress.
Okay, perfect.
So this is more practical for the shirt. Yeah. That would work for the pants, because then you take time.
Designer Gloria Wavamuno is trying to change that, attempting to introduce bark cloth into modern designs.
I am a lover of texture of clothing. I like to see that fabric has like lines and roughness or texture are like stories of a fabric. So just like, you know, lines and wrinkles on people, the same thing.
But Wavamuno and other designers have to battle the cultural stigma of bark cloth. While Bugandans use the cloth ceremonially, they also use it to wrap their dead for burial. Eunice Rukundo, editor of Kampala's Full Woman magazine, is among many who like seeing bark cloth designs on runways, but can't really imagine it on the street.
There's a scary element to it because we associate it with tradition and mystery, and maybe eventually they'll find a way of making it softer and more friendly. But right now, I don't know.
Wavamuno and other designers are working on making the cloth more user-friendly, easier to wear, and clean. You can imagine stretched-out tree bark needs special care. Wavamuno is also trying to integrate other traditional African materials into her work. Ugandan raw cotton, Ethiopian silks, brightly patterned fabrics from Ghana and Nigeria.
I think I just have that little bit of proudness that this is what we create in Uganda, because I think we're just full of so much beauty that's like from the root up.
Wavamuno says she plans to debut a clothing line featuring bark cloth sometime in the next year. I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Kimberly's Uganda stories are part of the African Great Lakes Reporting Initiative from the International Women's Media Foundation.
In 2013, the city of Detroit declared bankruptcy. Financial problems crippled city infrastructure, like public transportation and schools. And people who live there, who didn't or couldn't leave, had to make the best of it. Cassie Bracken is senior video journalist for the New York Times. She followed five students from a local high school in Detroit called Denby High School. She talked to them about their dreams for their futures and went back a year and a half later to find out how they're doing. Her video series is now online at the New York Times and on our website, marketplace.org. Cassie, great to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Describe, if you will, where Denby is located. What does Denby look like?
So it's funny. I took a drive with the principal to see how the city changes from where she wakes up every morning, which is downtown, which, you know, is being reinvigorated. And as she says, pop-up shops and these, you know, gourmet coffee stands. And about 15 minutes away, you go northeast of downtown and you will be where Denby High School is. And the visuals are quite different. When you look around the perimeter of the school, you don't see functioning homes. I mean, you see literally across the street was, a bombed out old apartment complex.
And once you were inside the school, once you'd picked Denby, how did you decide which students to follow?
Really just sitting in on classes and hearing some of the feedback from the students. One person that stuck out to me was Demetrius Smith, and we initially wanted to follow him because he was new to Detroit, and we thought he would, you know, provide sort of an interesting set of eyes.
I'm new to the state, so it's like, this is my first year here. So it's like, I like the school because it helped me get into college. The school has helped me out a lot. I love the school. So
we started following him in the fall. We became aware of a very tragic backstory. And in December, he stopped going to school. And we come to find out later that he was incarcerated. He was on probation in Ohio and had come to Detroit, at literally, as he put it, to get a high school diploma and hopefully attend college. So just the idea of coming to Detroit for opportunity seemed so ironic, given, you know, the way Detroit is portrayed and also sort of what we thought we would find from the students.
I wanted to ask you about Hakeem, who's one of your more traditional success stories. He gets a scholarship to Michigan State. He says he wants to come back to Detroit.
My uncles told me, don't come back. Ain't nothing here. But I want to go back to the city. That's my dream. That's what I'm going to do. There are a lot of people that's trying to make a change in the city. So why can't I?
I wonder how common that is, of wanting to make Detroit better, come back to the city.
It was definitely a common thing that I heard among the students, the idea of at some point coming, you know, if they were going to leave to go to college or, you know, in Tamandre's case, go to Job Corps to come back and improve the surrounding neighborhood that they live in.
And do you think you'll go back, follow these kids in the future?
I'd love to. I really would. They provided a lot of surprises for us. And, you know, again, I think I was intrigued by, you know, what happens to optimism and what happens to sense of possibility in a city that has, to some extent, declared itself a failure. And so to see the continued optimism with these students, despite their surroundings, was fascinating. And I'd love to check in and hope the best for all of them.
Casey Bracken is senior video journalist for the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Final note, bringing us back around to the Apple announcement today. One of the big unveils was the Apple Pencil. It's basically a stylus, which got Twitter making jokes about a decidedly anti-stylus presentation Steve Jobs made back in 2007.
Who wants a stylus? You have to get them and put them away and you lose them. Yuck. Nobody wants a stylus.
Wow. You got to wonder how many pieces of tech go from outdated yuck to one of the big stories of the day some 8 years later.
All right, that's it. That's our show for the day. Today, the Dow dropped 239 points, 1.4%. The Nasdaq gave back 55 points, 1.1%. And the S&P 500 was off 27 points, about 1.4%. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. I'm Adrienne Hill. Kai's back tomorrow. Have a good evening. This is 8 p.m.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.